to the Naval Academy Museum Warrior Riders Podcast. I'm your host, Sal, from the blog Commander Salamander. In this 14-part series, we'll take you decade by decade, starting with the 1870s, discussing the significant naval events and developments that helped shape the U.S. Navy to coincide with the Naval Academy Museum exhibit, Warrior Riders, the U.S. Naval Institute, open from September 10, 2015 through January 31, 2016. Our guest for each episode leading us through the decades will be Naval Academy History Professor Emeritus and noted Naval Historian Dr. Craig Simmons and Naval Academy Museum Director Claude Barabé. Craig, the last decade of the 19th century is often viewed as a turning point in the history of the U.S. Navy. Why is that?
Well, there were a number of things that took place, not only in the decade of the 1890s, but specifically in the year 1890. It's easier in hindsight to recognize a turning point looking back on it than it is at the time, so I'm not sure that anybody living in 1890 looked around and said, look how things are changing. But there were a number of things that became evident as harbingers of change in 1890, and I think the place to start is with the fact that the national census of that year, the 1890 census, which of course takes place every year that ends with a zero, for the first time indicated that there was no longer a continental frontier inside the United States. Every census that had been made since 1790 had included a map with a solid line drawn across it, beyond which it just said, well, this is frontier and unsettled, and we did not include population counts in those areas. The last time that happened was 1880, and in 1890 the map came out and said there are no longer any internal frontier areas. That's symbolic in a couple of ways. In fact, it became historically significant a few years later when a young history professor at the University of Wisconsin named Frederick Jackson Turner delivered a paper at the annual meeting of the American Historical Association pointing this out and saying, you know, this is significant because the United States has always been a country that was kind of based on its reaction to the frontier, you know, from go west young man to cowboys and Indians and all of this business, and now that frontier is gone. And the symbolism of that is that the United States now begins to look not just internally, but also externally. Now, as I say, that's more symbolic than it is real. It's not that suddenly policymakers decided, wow, we'd better have a Navy if we're looking outward. But coincidentally, that same year, that is in 1890, Congress did authorize the first three of what I think can be called the first modern American battleships. Now, the Maine and the Texas had been authorized in the mid-1880s, but as I mentioned when we talked last time, they were kind of defensive coastline battleships, not only in terms of the way they were designed, but in the way they were imagined and in the roles they were assigned. But the ships authorized in 1890, starting with the Indiana, they were the Indiana, Massachusetts, and Oregon, again, maintaining the tradition of naming battleships for states. The Indiana, interestingly, was designated as BB1, and Massachusetts was 2, and Oregon was 3, the implication being there are going to be more of these. So here's the first evidence of the United States Navy building a battleship fleet, not just for coastal defense, not just to protect the harbors, but battleships that could steam out to sea and do battle with enemy battleships. So those two things together, the disappearance of the frontier, the authorization of seagoing battleships, I think are significant in defining 1890 as a turning point. And there's one other thing I'm going to mention, but I'm pretty sure you're going to ask me about this anyway, and that is that in 1890, Alfred Thayer Mahan also published his famous book about the influence of sea power upon history, and that had a big impact as well.
I think one of the neater developments in the last few years is Alfred Thayer Mahan. He really has enjoyed a renaissance in places that he may not have expected, from China and other developing nations in the 21st century, as they look at how they want to apply sea power. But going back into his time in the 1890s, how influential was that writing during that decade?
Well, I think Mahan's genius, if it was genius, was in his timing. The ideas he presented were not entirely new, not entirely original, but they came at exactly the right time to hit exactly the right note to substantiate and validate a process that was already underway. What Mahan did, Mahan was a lecturer at this brand new Naval War College that Stephen B. Luce had set up in the 1880s. In fact, became its president, I think, in 1888. And his job there was to present lectures to the officer students about strategy, how to think about strategy, not just how to drive a ship and how to maneuver and how to shoot your guns, but thinking more broadly about the relationship between strategy and national policy issues. And that's still, of course, its mission today. And Mahan wrestled with how to do this, and he thought one of the best ways to do it was through historical case studies. And the case study he picked was that of the Royal Navy in its wars between with the Dutch in the 17th century and the French in the 18th century. And from this series of lectures about naval battles in the Age of Sail, he developed a philosophy of naval power that said, you know, if you have certain characteristics of it as a nation, and he listed these, are seven or so of them, you know, you have to have resources and an appropriate geography with a coastline and a certain amount of insularity. The character of your people have to be such that they're interested in the sea. And if you have these things and you build a navy and you depend on that navy, the nation with the most powerful battleship navy will triumph. It's the only way you can explain a tiny little nation like England defeating a continental power like Napoleonic France. It just doesn't make sense any other way. And in presenting these issues in that way, it was almost as if he was setting up a formula. You know, if you do these things, if you build a battleship fleet, if your battleship fleet is competitive, is dominant over the battleship fleets of other nations, you will become a great power. And that has resonated not only in his own time. Obviously, it caught the rising tide of America's new interest overseas and the building of these new battleships. But it has resonated, as you mentioned in your question, throughout the 100-and-some-odd years since then, with nations aspiring to become naval powers. It's a template. It's a format. It's a play. A game plan for becoming a great naval power, and its timing was perfect. Published in 1890, it not only influenced Congress and further appropriations to the Navy, it was translated quickly into German, where the Germans thought, what a brilliant idea, we'll build one too. The Japanese, of course, who looked at the English example and said, look at this, a small island power becoming world dominant through the construction of a Navy, we can do that too. So Mahan's influence was quite evident at the time, and as you mentioned, since as well.
And in the last decade of the 19th century, there was a splendid demonstration of this revolution in naval thinking through what was then called a splendid little war. And, of course, we're talking about the Spanish-American War in 1898. What were the origins of this war, and why was it so important?
Well, it's interesting because I think, let me start with the importance first, then I'll get back to the origins. The importance is that it is America's first extra-continental war, if you would. It's not that we hadn't fought European powers, the French in the Quasi-War, the British in the War of 1812. We fought the Mexicans in 1847. We fought each other in the 1860s. But here's a war in which the United States is fighting a European power beyond its own shores. That is, the battlefields themselves took place beyond our own shores. And it's a coming out party, if you would, for the new battleship navy that Congress had authorized at the beginning of the decade. It's a validation of Mahan's argument that the nation with the dominant battleship fleet will gain power, prestige, and influence in the wielding of that fleet. And so its importance is that the United States announces itself as a world power in 1898 with its defeat of Spain. I will say that we were, you know, perhaps lucky in our selection of an opponent here. We'd have had a lot of trouble with any other European power, but Spain at that time was not only in a state of economic decline, they'd allowed their navy to atrophy. Their heart was not in this war particularly. They fought it more out of pride than any other reason. So defeating the navy of a European power, even a declining European power like Spain was at the time, announced America's emergence on the world stage. Now, the origins of this thing go way back. We mentioned when we were talking about the 1870s about revolutions in Cuba and Americans sympathizing with that revolutionary instinct. You know, we had won our independence through a revolution against a European colonial power, and we kind of thought of the Latin American nations as striving for that same goal. So there was a lot of innate sympathy among the population of the United States for the Cubans seeking independence from Spain. And, you know, Americans even volunteered to go down and fight on behalf of the Cuban rebels. What happened in the middle to late 1890s is Spain imposed a particularly draconian counter-revolutionary strategy that involved taking the citizens out of the towns, concentrating them in areas, and then guarding them, supposedly to keep them safe, but also to keep them from causing trouble. And they gave a name to them. They called them concentration camps. It's the first use of that term, which would become, of course, a 20th century phenomenon in many ways. But it so outraged the American public that newspaper publishers in the United States said, well, this is terrible. We have to do something about it. And to demonstrate our sympathy, McKinley authorized the sending of a battleship down to Havana Harbor, supposedly on a goodwill gesture, but really to show, hey, look, we're watching, we're paying attention, don't overplay your hand here. And that, of course, was the USS Maine, the first battleship of the modern era. And the Maine, almost certainly through an internal coal explosion, blew up and sank in Havana Harbor. But given the mood of the time, everybody just assumed, well, the Spanish must have done this, those terrible Spaniards who were oppressing the Cubans. We won't stand for it, and Congress declared war. So that's how it got started. And what characterized this war, and again, we go back to the Mahanian interpretation of the use of navies, is that because Mahan had argued that the first thing you should do in a war is suppress the enemy's battle fleet, Commodore Dewey, commanding the Asian squadron on the China coast, was ordered to go to the Spanish Philippines and take on the Spanish squadron there. Well, our ships were significantly newer, faster, better armed, better protected than the Spanish squadron. So they steamed into Manila Bay and pretty much wiped out the Spanish squadron in a couple of hours. It was very much a one-sided affair. It made Dewey a national hero, but it also created a dilemma for McKinley, because now that we've defeated the Spanish Navy, the Philippines by default kind of fell into our lap. And the question was, well, what shall we do with them? I guess we could just sail away and let them do whatever, but that would lead to chaos, and that's an irresponsible thing. The Germans were nearby. They were perfectly willing to step in and take over, but we didn't want that either. So we decided, well, I guess the only reasonable thing to do here is to annex the Philippines. And that's a significant decision, because that is what made the United States, again, for the first time, a colonial power. Now we had territorial possessions, not part of the contiguous United States, that nobody really seriously considered making part of the United States, but were nevertheless under our sovereign control. And that changed the dynamic of the United States as well.
We've already seen a lot of big changes at the end of the 19th century when it comes to naval technology and how the Navy can influence a nation's global power. But the victory in the Spanish-American War, how did that American victory spur continued change, not just in our Navy, but even internationally, if people looked at the results?
Well, in a couple of ways. One is technological. This, of course, is a half century of dramatic technological change. I suppose that's still going on. If you look at the most modern ships in the U.S. Navy today, there's a lot of technological change still underway. But one of them here was the ability of ships to operate at long distances. You know, the U.S. Navy, since its founding, had been one that operated within relatively secure distance of the coast, and especially with the coming of steam propulsion, we needed to have bases close enough that those ships wouldn't, you know, run out of gas, metaphorically, in the middle of the ocean somewhere. Well, now we have the Philippines that are our responsibility. We have a fleet over there. How do we maintain that? So the impact on the designing of what are called long-legged ships, ships able to operate at greater distances from a friendly port, becomes important. But also, and I think this is really part of the point I made in response to your last question, and that is that the American occupation of the Philippines created a kind of foot in the door for the United States to become a world power beyond its own shores. Interestingly enough, during the Spanish-American War, there was a sort of contrived revolution in Hawaii where American businessmen took over the Hawaiian kingdom from the royal family there, petitioned for annexation to the United States, which was granted in this new flush of overseas interest. Midway, that tiny little island atoll of Midway, had been annexed by the United States in 1867 as a coaling station, and now both Guam and the Philippines are annexed to the United States as a result of the Spanish-American War, so that if you look at a map of the Pacific, it's almost like a series of stepping stones from the west coast of the United States to Hawaii, to Midway, to Guam, and to the Philippines. You can see this path leading to new American interest in the Far East, and the United States thus becomes one of the so-called great powers that have a hand in deciding the future of, at that time, Chinese politics on the mainland of Asia. So it has a dramatic impact on America's perception of its role in the world, its future path of international relations, as well as on technology.
And Craig, with that, we bring the 19th century to a close and look forward to joining you for the first decade of the 20th century for our next episode.
That'll be great. Thanks, Al.
Claude, in the last decade of the 19th century, we really see the ending of the Romantic era, the days of sail, and we move into the days of steel and steam. And it's also a time where U.S. naval power broke above the historical ambient noise like never before and really brought us into, in many ways, the modern era from both appearances and thought. And when we were talking with Craig earlier on in the show, one of the ships we talk about that in many ways epitomizes not just the major conflict of the time, which was the Spanish-American War, but also the technological change that we saw in the 1890s. And that was the USS Maine. And I know over at the Naval Academy Museum, y'all have the largest ship model collection people can view in person in one seating. You can really see that evolution, and y'all have a really unique model of the USS Maine. If you could take some time to describe that and what it represents.
Certainly. The largest collection refers to the original British dockyard models. In fact, that's the reason that Preble Hall, the museum, was built in 1939. 1936, one of the wealthiest men in America, Henry Huddleston Rogers, had bequeathed in his will to us a number of original British dockyard models. Now, these are the models that were built at the same time as the ship. So we have ships that range from about 200 years old to the oldest known in the world, that's 350 years old. We have the second largest collection of British dockyard models in the world, second only to England, but we actually display more than they do at this point. So when Huddleston was going around England in the 1920s, he was purchasing a lot of these because a lot of the estates were looking to raise money. And when he bequeathed them, he said, I need to find a place for them, and I want it to be the Naval Academy, and you must build a museum. Now, we had a museum of sorts in several rooms prior to that, but this was the first time we had the ability to have a museum, and the Naval Institute, as I mentioned in one of the previous podcasts, came along and they donated money as well to the construction of what eventually became known as Preble Hall, and they were co-located with us from 1939 to 1999. The collection requires, by congressional authorization, an expert boat model curator. We've only had four of them, and it is the only congressionally authorized position at the Naval Academy. The work that they do is not solely restricted to the older dockyard models. It is also with regard to building new models of more modern ships past 200 years, as well as repairing them. In the case of the USS Maine, we do not have it on display. In our basement, we have a boat model shop where our boat model curator works, as well as a volunteer club of about 20 men and women who come in on Thursday evenings and Saturday mornings. And they are at work on a number of different projects. We've got one person who's building an almost completed building, the new USS New Ironsides, which was constructed during the Civil War. We have someone who is nearing completion of the USS Stark, which will go on display in a few months, and others who are building flying boats, or in some cases they recently completed the USS Chicago of the ABCD, that squadron of evolution. In the case of the USS Maine, which people can see through a window into the boat model shop, that is not on display, but they've been slowly working on it. And the reason why is because they're building it to its original intent. We tend to think of this new Navy, this new steel Navy, as simply steam. And we spoke about this in an earlier podcast, this how some ships were still had sail to, because it was far more efficient until the engines could make that next leap to new technologies. In the case of the USS Maine, they're building it with her. It's actually the original builder's model, and they'll be putting the masts on that ship in the next few months. So people don't realize that the original USS Maine did have masts, and that's how we're going to display it. And we think that once we display it, it will cause great controversy and discussion, and we hope that's the case.
We can also find in the 1890s some significant personalities and also people who had lack of a better phrase, a large influence on some of the significant personalities of the 20th century. Who can we find writing at this time that people will recognize?
Some of the biggest names in the business, and I think I should preface it with, it's a very special time for the Navy. Because just as you had that Naval Lyceum and the Naval Magazine of the 1830s, this new crop of junior officers who really were exploring new ways of educating officers, who were exploring new technologies such as steam and how to introduce that, albeit slowly, and who would eventually lead the country's squadrons in both the Mexican-American War as well as the Civil War. You had something similar happening in the 1890s. The generation that had come up with founding the Naval Institute had now been around for 15, 16, 17 years, and the ideas that they had been proposing about modernizing the fleet, about war colleges, about embracing Mahan, who had written for Proceedings, and as well as Luce, and looking at grand strategy, this was all coming to fruition. There was a maturity of their thought, and they were starting to see the fruition of the fruits of their labor. It must have been an incredibly professionally rewarding decade for them, because they finally found the Navy was now the premier service again. It had fallen out of service, if you will, for about 30 years with a push westward, with the last decades of Manifest Destiny. But here was an opportunity that the Navy had with regard to the Spanish-American War, regardless of the reason why we got into it. Those were the officers that benefited from their articles, their thoughts, and eventually would take that learning to the next generation. In terms of some of the individuals that are represented in the Warrior Writer exhibit, of course, we have an assistant secretary of the Navy named Theodore Roosevelt, who we have a framed letter on ironclad vessels on exhibit, where he discusses a couple of things. He talks about What is a modern ship? Is a monitor really a modern ship if it's the 1890s? Because we've come so far in just a few decades. We also have a framed letter, his review of Mahan's influence of sea power upon history. So I think TR's writings are very influential because certainly he had such a great role, and there's a wonderful book by Dr. Jerry Hendricks, a retired captain, on the subject. Another figure is Ed Beach Sr., Captain Ed Beach, who had been at the Battle of Manila Bay. He had been Secretary Treasurer of the Naval Institute, and he publishes the first Blue Jackets Manual. And so it's during this decade, actually, in 1899, that Naval Institute expands its offerings. It's not only providing a magazine called Proceedings, it now establishes the Naval Institute Press, which has now been going on for now 116 years. And Beach has a son, Ned Beach, who goes on to command the Triton, USS Triton, a submarine, who would also be an author. Ed Beach Sr. had written 13 young adult novels, as well as some nonfiction work and Proceedings. Ned Beach also takes that cue, and when he's the naval aide to President Eisenhower, he would go home at night and write a novel called Run Silent, Run Deep, which becomes one of the seminal Navy works of fiction in the mid-20th century. Another author is William Halsey Sr., Captain William Halsey, USNA class of 1873. Of course, we're more familiar with his son, known as Bull Halsey, one of the great admirals of the Second World War. Another figure is Richmond Pearson Hobson, Naval Academy class of 1889. He got the Honorable Mention Prize essay in 1895 for a summary of the situation and outlook in Europe. So again, we're starting to see this new generation really reaching out around the world and trying to identify what the navies and the country's roles are in the world. Richard Wainwright Sr. Is very influential as well. He actually publishes the first book through Naval Institute Press, which is called The Log of the Gloucester, a ship he had commanded. And he goes on to become superintendent of the academy just a couple of years later. He's there when Teddy Roosevelt visits the Naval Academy, and his son, Richard Wainwright Jr., is a student graduating at the time. Richard Wainwright Jr. also distinguishes himself with a Medal of Honor because of Veracruz. George Dewey, Naval Academy class of 1858, goes on to be an instructor at the Naval Academy, writes a report on Manila Bay that's eventually published in Proceedings. So I think these are some of the big figures and some of the people we would still recognize today. And even Wainwright, whose family had a very distinguished military record stretching from the Civil War right through World War II.
Going along with the personalities that are also, especially for museum geeks, like I think it's safe to say we both are fit that category, you also have the artifacts. What artifacts do we have on display at the Naval Academy Museum from this time?
Sure. We have a portrait of Ed Beach Sr. I mentioned already some of the framed letters that we have from Theodore Roosevelt. For George Dewey, we have his sherry glass, and why not have a sherry glass if you've got one? It was part of his collection aboard his ship, the Olympia. We also have a sword, a Tiffany sword, that's displayed in our main pen and sword case as somebody walks into the special exhibit that belonged to Richard Wainwright. It's one of three Tiffany swords that we at the Naval Academy Museum have. A second one is the Warden sword. John Warden was one of the founders of the Naval Institute. He had been superintendent of the Academy, as we mentioned before, and had been commander of the USS Monitor. So that is still on permanent display at the museum. For Richmond Pearson Hobson, we have a couple of items. We have his cap as an admiral. We don't have his Medal of Honor medal, but we do have an incredible portrait of him as an admiral. And part of that portrait in a corner, you can see number of ships that he painted himself. So he became part of that artwork as well.
And Claude, with that, we wind up the 19th century, and we'll join you next episode as we hit the 1900s.